This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
Welcome to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680, WPTF News, Talk, Traffic. Thank you so much for being here with us this afternoon. I am Jason Kong alongside Carson Sellers of Transitions Life Care. Carson, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. What about yourself?
I'm doing great. Excited for the program today, something that we have not talked about before.
Too.
And something that I know you are very excited to talk about.
Very excited.
And we are going to be talking about Transitions Kids. And we are so lucky to have on the show with us today Dr. Sophia Paraskos. She is Medical Director of Transitions Kids. Dr. Paraskos, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes, we are excited for the conversation today. Carson, where should we start?
Yeah, absolutely. Really looking forward to our conversation today. I wanted to get into a service of Transitions Life Care, Transitions Kids. It's something that I feel like not a lot of people know about as much as our main services. So let's dive right in. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about you and how you got into this industry and just about your position at Transitions Kids?
Sure. I have kind of a unique background, I think. I started off as a religion major in college and was really interested in the kind of anthropology of religion, and then also was doing some pre-med classes alongside that and found that intersection of religion and suffering to be very meaningful for me. And so starting out more as an educational endeavor, and then when I decided to go to medical school, that just really felt, it really jived with the religion and suffering part of things. As a medical student and then subsequently doing internal medicine and pediatrics residency, I definitely gravitated toward the more seriously ill population. And so in both adults and kids, I was able to see the benefit of palliative care and hospice to families. And so after I finished my four-year training, I did a fellowship in it was at the time, it's just a adult palliative care and hospice fellowship. Right. But I was at UNC and we were able to make it definitely a combined training in adult and pediatric palliative care and hospice. And part of that training, actually part of the fellowship, was time with the Transitions Kids program through Transitions Life Care. And so I got to be like the fellow on the team originally and started getting to know more about what palliative care and hospice look like in the community setting, which was definitely not something that I got a lot of during my formal medical training, and then decided to stay on. And I now do a very unusual combination of 2 days of medical director with the kids team, 2 days of adult hospice, and then I also do some primary care alongside that. But it's been very rewarding to get here.
Wow, that's awesome. That's quite the journey. And now it sounds like you do a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Can you start by just giving us a bit of an overview of our Transitions Kids program and the unique needs it addresses?
Yes. Yeah. So Transitions Kids encompasses, I would say, three domains of care. There's palliative care, and we can talk about the differences among these, but palliative care, there's hospice care, which is also called concurrent care, and then there is our bereavement program. And so we are part of we can be part of the illness journey with these families from diagnosis all the way up to and through bereavement. And the difference, there are many differences and many similarities. So for the audience who's familiar with palliative care, this will sound probably familiar, but basically palliative care is a type of medicine that specializes in, I think, of four things: symptom management, coordination with other medical teams, and discussion around goals of care, what's important to families and quality of life, and then how we can implement those into medical decision making. And so we can be part of anytime there's a serious illness that's diagnosed. It does not have to be immediately fatal. It can be something that in our population, sometimes kids are born with. But anytime there's a serious illness, a palliative care team can be involved. And the sooner, the better. There might not be something that we can, we may not need to be involved on a daily or weekly or monthly basis, but for a lot of our families, we're getting involved years down the line, and many of them are just so grateful that our team is able to address questions that they've had since their child was born, oftentimes that nobody else is really willing to or able to address, kind of like the elephant in the room analogy. So that is the palliative care side of things. Hospice has a similar focus in terms of the domains of what we can offer, but hospice has the same criteria in kids that it does for adults in terms of needing to have a 6-month expected prognosis. So when you're in that last chapter of life is when hospice is appropriate. That's true in adults and kids, but there's a huge difference in terms of how we apply the hospice benefit in children. Because you may be familiar with the need in adults for patients who are considering hospice to have to discontinue their disease-directed care. So an easy example is if you have cancer and you've been doing chemotherapy, radiation, surgery to treat your cancer, if you want to transition to hospice care, you have to give up those disease-directed or curative treatments in order to receive hospice. In kids, we don't have that stipulation. So you can continue to receive any disease-directed care through your time on hospice. And insurances have carved out ways to do both of those things concurrently. That's why it has that name. And we can go a little bit more into the history of that and how we've rolled that out in North Carolina. But that's what hospice looks like. And then the bereavement side for our team is both able to support family, siblings, parents, any family of children who have died on our team, but also provides bereavement support to the remainder of children in the community and patients of people who've died on our big transitions hospice. Even if you haven't been connected to transitions at all, you can still be seen by a grief counselor with transitions kids. There are lots of camps and support groups that we offer for children. That's been a really robust part of our last few years in effort to make that accessible to the community as well.
Absolutely, yes. And we are going to dive into all of that more specifically. That was a great overview. Just one more question before we go to a quick break. I know you're talking about how pediatric hospice is different from the care provided to adults because curative treatments can still continue. Are there any other specific differences there when it comes to the kids' hospice benefit?
So I'd say there are, I think it helps probably, and maybe your listeners have more familiarity with hospice, but it certainly helped me to have a deep dive into what adult hospice looks like before differentiating it from kids. And so when we think about traditional hospice, we're thinking about things like availability of medications that come through the hospice. We're thinking about equipment that comes through the hospice, support from a social worker, or in our case, social workers and chaplains fill the same role on adult hospice. That's a little bit different, but both of those domains are involved. And then the wraparound, those are considered more like the wraparound services. There's a weekly nurse visit that's the kind of foundation for how hospice looks on the ground. And then there's also, that's kind of the minimum of which you need to be seen, but there's availability if things are changing, if there are symptoms arising, for a nurse to come out and evaluate not only other days of the week, but also after hours. And so if you are getting sicker, we anticipate that you will need more care available around the clock. It is not that we stay in your house around the clock or provide, you know, private duty nursing. That's a separate benefit, unfortunately, but we are able to provide symptom management support any hour of the day, and that's a big difference from palliative care. So I would say on kids, the way that looks different, it encompasses all of those things, but there are some differences in the way that we provide we call it family support. It's a huge, you know, probably the most robust part of our team. Is the access to our family support specialists, who are social workers and chaplains, are really engaged in supporting the siblings and parents of the child who might be at the center of things. And so we can talk more about how that looks, but I'd say that's one of the biggest differences.
Absolutely. That's very important.
Yeah, we want to dive into a whole lot more with Dr. Sophia Perasco. She is medical director of Transitions Kids, and that's what we're talking about this program. We're going in depth on Transitions Kids, which is part of Transitions Life Care, and we'll do that. Got more. Stick around. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9. AM 680 WPTF News Talk Traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF AM 680 and WPTF.com with your host, Mary Lucas and Jason Kong.
Welcome back to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680 WPTF News Talk Traffic. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Jason Kong, alongside Carson Sellers, and we are so happy to have on the line with us Dr. Sophia Perasco. She is medical director of Transitions Kids, and we are talking about all things related to Transitions Kids. And Carson, just before the break, we kind of got our background of Dr. Perasco's as well as an overview of what Transitions Kids is. And now we want to kind of really dive into to the nitty-gritty of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So continuing kind of where we left off about curative treatments and how that applies differently to children's hospice and children's palliative care. How do you collaborate with other doctors and specialists to ensure that a child is receiving both palliative care and curative treatments when it's appropriate?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest skills that I've had to hone that's different from my work on the adult side is as the pediatric MD, either on palliative care or hospice, you're sort of becoming like the quarterback of that patient's care, depending on what the family's goals are and how much their foot is still in the world of their curative treatment and interfacing with those providers. That is, you know, one side of things. If they're earlier in their disease process, they're definitely oftentimes much more invested in all of their many subspecialists compared to once a child has gotten sicker and sicker and is more on the hospice side of things, approaching end of life, where we're kind of taking over care. I think one of the absolute core principles of what we do on the ped side is coordinate care. That is what I was doing before I came on this call, is trying to figure out how to get providers on the same page, which is one of the biggest complaints of patients in their healthcare system, especially these children who have very complex medical illness, and maybe they're, you know, one of only 100 kids in the country who has an illness like this, and they're coordinating with their geneticists and their neurologists and their pulmonologists and GI specialists, and we are then trying to gather all of those different opinions and cast that in light of the family's goals of care and what's important to them. And so I spend a lot of time interfacing with other doctors, emailing, you know, using the electronic medical record to reach out. Sometimes, you know, for our patients who are getting sicker and maybe goals of care are shifting, we are oftentimes like, I'll send a, you know, an email that includes all of their subspecialists on it and try to get everybody on the same page about what that means. We want to be really sure that we're speaking the same language. And so I think one of the things that's a myth about palliative care, which I try to debunk every minute of my life, is that we have to be a team that's involved when the goals are focused around comfort. And that's true on the adult side too. I think people have this misconception that you are quote unquote going palliative care or you're transitioning to palliative care. And that's really not the right way to think about what our team can offer. So palliative care is alongside other types of disease-directed treatment. So if you are undergoing chemotherapy and other treatments that might actually hinder your quality of life, you want a palliative care team there to help, you know, with nausea relief, with pain relief, to kind of be part of the team and part of the conversation. We're experts in managing symptoms. And so we can help your primary teams with things that oftentimes are within the scope of their practice, but sometimes not. And I think that that part of that is communicating with other members on the team. So one of the things I always try to be very careful about before meeting a family for the first time is trying to have a conversation with their other care team members, even before that, to say, what has this family heard about their disease, the prognosis, the symptom management, and kind of disease-directed options that are available to them that they're going to be weighing when trying to make complex medical decisions, so that when I hear from the family, I can have a sense of how much they've really gleaned from conversations with those primary providers, and then can work to help communication rather than providing my own assessment of the situation, which may be different than another doctor's. So I think that's a very important part of what we do. And I think that pertains as well to the adult side, but it's definitely something that is part of our kids team approach. And then as they get sicker, that communication evolves and becomes more of, you know, what we can offer at home up through and including end of life if the family wants to try for or think about a home death versus when we would return to the hospital. And that's really a much bigger separate conversation, but for sure the communication with these teams goes through that entire process. And I think that is something we do exceptionally well, and the providers with whom I'm communicating are always very grateful for that ongoing communication. I try to debunk that myth with them as well, that if they refer to a palliative care team, they are giving up hope, or they are, we're going to kind of take over care for their patient. None of that is true. And I think the way we combat that is with really good communication with other teams.
Absolutely. Communication is very important, especially when there's so many moving parts when it comes to things like this. Diving even further into what palliative care looks like in a pediatric setting and how it supports quality of life regardless of prognosis, are there any other specific challenges or approaches that differ from what we see in adult palliative care? And what are the goals of palliative care for children?
So I always say that, you know, my goals are really not relevant. Whatever the family's goals are become my goals. So if a family is focused really on life extension, aggressive treatment, still kind of doing everything possible to extend the child's life, which is very common in some of our patients, that is my goal. And I become focused on prioritizing life extending measures. And also usually embedded in that for families is we want to do that, but simultaneously offer as much quality of life and comfort. And so balancing those two things become the focus of our team. We're going to pursue this aggressive chemotherapy, but we're also going to aggressively treat symptoms that might come along with that. And so we are working to make sure we're on the same page and supporting the family's goals. We are not going to come in and say, well, we think that since your child has a shortened lifespan that you should be just focused on comfort. We're going to support whatever your goals are. And I think one thing that's really different and would maybe help to clarify, Carson, is like what the different types of diagnoses are on the pediatric side versus adults. I've talked some about cancer. And I think in people's minds, like hospice, cancer, in some ways it just that naturally flows. But in peds, the majority of our patients are actually not oncology patients, although we definitely have, I can give you the percentage breakdown in the last couple of years, we have about 16% of our patients are oncology patients, but then the rest of them, the vast majority, fall into what we call chromosomal abnormalities or neurological diagnoses. And that's things like something that you are born with and that you probably have known from the time that child was born or soon after that they are going to have some developmental delays, maybe not be able to eat on their own or walk or talk. And so families have been really preparing for a very different life for their child than they anticipated. And there's so much grief that comes along with that knowledge early on. And we are getting involved oftentimes really late, really far after that grief has already been ongoing for years and years. So like I said, those are sometimes families where have you been? This team that could help me kind of process these big emotions, you know, for years. If we are getting involved on the earlier side, that can be a huge benefit to families. But yeah, so like 50-60% of our patients are on that side of the spectrum. And for those families, we can be a really, the family support side of things can be a huge benefit. The other thing we're doing in those families is, you know, I'd say in terms of what our care looks like, we are oftentimes in, up front, we might have visits more frequently. We're talking about things like quality of life first and foremost. What are you hoping for your child? What are you worried about for your child and your family? How does this, you know, child and their illness fit into your family structure? But also, what does their quality of life look like? What's important to them? What makes them happy? A lot of these kids are still able to enjoy really good quality of life. And that's really defined by what their parents view as good quality of life. So it's important that I'm not looking at a situation and saying, well, I don't think this is good quality of life. It's really what the family views as good quality of life for that child. And once we've established those things, then you can go on to have a more meaningful discussion about, you know, what the prognosis is, what disease treatments they're being offered, and how that might factor into their, like how their goals of care, that's what we call those, determining what's important to a family, how those might influence what treatment options they're going to seek or not seek. So it's really, I think we oftentimes think about in terms of like getting a medical update, here's the prognosis, here are the medical options. Without assessing what's important to the family, that conversation is totally empty. And so we try to put that first. We get to know the family, get to know the child. That's what I always say is the best part of a palliative care doctor's job, is that my job is to get to know you. And then from there, we can figure out what decisions are appropriate for your family. And the way we do that might be through, we call this advanced care planning. If we're getting involved early enough in the disease course that we're able to say, hey, listen, this is, you know, this is what we know about this disease, or a lot of times our patients are in these incredibly rare disease cohorts where we might not have a sense of anything in terms of what their development might look like, what their lifespan might look like. We're helping families cope with uncertainty around that. But if we are able to kind of forecast into the future and say, what are some, you know, if you were, you know, at the point where things are changing and we're getting sicker, what kinds of interventions feel appropriate to you in terms of life extension versus would we want to focus more on symptom management and comfort at a certain point? And we do get into questions around, I think people always think that we're going to address code status. Do you want to be DNR? And those conversations, I think, are really downstream of what we can offer. And it's not that they're not important. Of course, they are very important. But if we're lucky enough to be meeting a patient when things are stable and going well, we can address those things in time after we build some trust with families. And it's not usually the top priority unless we're meeting someone in a setting that we're approaching, you know, quickly approaching medical instability or end of life. But hopefully we're meeting them earlier than that.
Yeah, having those open lines of communication really is critical for getting everyone on the same page. We're speaking with Dr. Sophia Parascos. She is Medical Director of Transitions Kids. We've got more with her right after this. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680, WPTF News, Talk, Traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. 60 minutes devoted to giving you all the information you need when caring for a loved one with Mary Lucas and Jason Kong. If you have questions for the show, you can email agingmatters@transitionslifecare.org.
You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680 WPTF News, Talk, Traffic. If you want to learn more about Transitions Life Care or Transitions Kids, be sure to head online to transitionslifecare.org. transitionslifecare.org. Jason Kong here with Carson Sellers in the studio. We are so lucky to have on the line with us Dr. Sophia Parascos. She is Medical Director of Transitions Kids, and we are doing a deep dive into Transitions Kids, and we've covered a lot of ground so far, Carson, and we've talked a lot about the care side of things, but I know we want to broaden things up just a little bit and talk about transitions kids and the services provided to the family, not just the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's something very important that people may not know that we provide. A lot of the services seem to revolve around the patient, as it should be, but the family is also there going through that as well. And I think that Transitions Kids has a lot of great things that we offer. So I know we touched on it a little bit earlier, but how does Transitions Kids support not just the child, but also their family members throughout their journey? And what are some of these services that we offer to the family?
So we have the most strong part of our program is the family support side. And so we have a number of licensed clinical social workers and chaplains who fill this family support role. And that's how they would be introduced. And we oftentimes will start with, depending on the needs of the family, we'll try to decide how many of those team members need to be involved. So if we've got, for example, the patient at the center who may need a family support person, but maybe they're a baby and that's less important. Or maybe the family isn't interested in having their own support person for the patient. We could have one person for the parents, or sometimes we assess a need to have one family support person for each parent, because this whole process can hit really differently, can hit a marriage very differently. So having some individual kind of counseling around that. And then on the other hand, there are also siblings that are impacted in many of our families. And so sometimes we'll have, if there's one sibling or two siblings, they might benefit from having their own family support person. And I think that's something that's very unique. It's something that we do really well on our team. That's at the discretion of the family. If that feels beneficial, that's something that we can work to involve. And then that support goes, from the time that they're enrolled in our services all the way up to and after the child dies, if we're supporting a child who's dying. But bereavement services, if we've made a connection with the family, that would continue after the child dies as well. There are also, I think what I briefly touched on this, but the bereavement options available to the sibling support, which I think of as being just a very important part of our team, with support groups, with individual counseling that's usually with the same person that kind of accompanied them alongside as their sibling was dying. We also help with, like, in schools, we've connected with guidance counselors before. We're supporting, not necessarily individually supporting friends of this child at school, but giving support to the guidance counselors who are often managing those things. And then supporting the medical teams too. That's a big part of our opportunities for supporting are also beyond the family and into the community, and the medical teams fall into that category as well.
Absolutely. Those are some great services. So in addressing these challenges, what do you think are some of the emotional and psychological challenges faced by families caring for a child with a serious illness? And how do our services address these?
Yeah, I mean, it's endless, as you can imagine. This is either something that, the family was having a healthy pregnancy and then had to confront a devastating diagnosis during a pregnancy or soon after birth. Or in other cases, our kids who were healthy, thriving children up until receiving a devastating diagnosis, well into childhood or into their teen or young adult years even. So I think it looks very different depending on what the scenario is. But this puts a strain on families in terms of course, care for the child, but also care for the other siblings of that child, for, like I said, the marriage, figuring out, finances and whether a parent can still work. Can that parent go back to work after receiving this diagnosis? And then if only one parent is working, how that impacts things. If both parents have to continue to work, we're working with a lot of families who have had their finances hugely disrupted and are really struggling. And that is another aspect of our team that I think we'll talk a little bit more about the funding, but we do receive some philanthropy, and that's a big part of our mission. But we're also able to connect families who don't have resources to other community community-based resources. Everyone has heard of Make-A-Wish, but there are a few others that are involved and can help our indigent families with things like paying their gas bills, paying their light bills. Those are all things that when you have a medically complex child become much, much more difficult. And you can imagine, you know, our medical system is ideally set up to provide some home nursing to our children with chronic complex medical illness. Some of these children have tracheostomies, have G-tubes and lots of medical equipment. And if a parent has to work and is not able to be there, they're relying on home private duty nurses to help with some of those things. So the complexity is really magnitudes and magnitudes and quite different from the adult population that we serve, although I think everybody at some point in their life has had to confront caring for a family member with complex medical illness. And when it's your child, that takes on just a much bigger toll.
Oh, absolutely. And you touched a little bit on the funding and reimbursement aspect. As we look ahead, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges in pediatric hospice care? Specifically, how do funding and reimbursement issues affect the services provided?
Yeah. So I have been doing this since 2018, and we have come a long way, I would say, with some aspects of getting this care better reimbursed. When I first started, so I'll just speak to the history of the Concurrent Care Act, which is part of the Affordable Care Act. In 2010, that was passed into law. That was Obamacare. And that, at the time, there was a provision within that. So any child receiving Medicaid or CHIP would be eligible for this concept called concurrent care. And definitely the early attempts to make that happen were very rocky. The way that that traditional hospice works is that once you, as an adult, decide to switch to hospice care, your insurance will basically stop paying for the aggressive disease-directed interventions and start paying a hospice a certain amount of money every day to provide the services that we discussed before, the nursing, social work, volunteers, those wraparound services. So that hospice gets a per diem. That's what that's called. And in turn, the hospice is then paying for things like those supportive services, but also medications. And the medications fall under a smaller umbrella because they're more comfort-focused medications.
Right.
So they're not things like chemotherapy or these very expensive, oftentimes, medications for seizures that many of our kids have. Or experimental medications that our children might be on. You can imagine that for a child who is going to continue those interventions and medications, that a hospice needs to have a guarantee that those medications are going to be continue to be covered by their primary insurance, and that the hospice won't get saddled with the bill for those medications, because hospices are oftentimes not for profit. We definitely are not going to be able to support that. So when we first started trying to do concurrent care with Medicaid in North Carolina, those things didn't work well. So the bill would sometimes go to the small, oftentimes an adult hospice that's trying to take on the child's care, and that would be a real problem. And so those hospices might not agree to take another child because of that. What we worked to do early on was push concurrent care, and when it failed, we would take these kids basically for with no reimbursement. So our philanthropy really was going to managing the support services for these kids without the per diem reimbursement because we weren't formally electing their hospice benefit. In recent years, that has improved quite a bit. So Medicaid has been doing much, much better with continuing efforts at concurrent care. So our children have been enjoying much better success with being able to get full hospice benefit from our team and other hospices throughout the state, and still getting their concurrent care through their insurance, so continuing with their disease-directed therapies. That is the biggest change, I would say, to our funding stream. The problem is that palliative care remains very poorly funded. So palliative care is inherently interdisciplinary. That means you're getting a MD, RN, a nurse, and a doctor, and then also the family support folks, so the chaplain, the social worker. And those services are not reimbursed at all beyond the physician appointment that might happen once every month or once every 3 months or every 6 months. And in between, if you're getting visits from the family support folks on our team, those, none of that is being reimbursed. And so and in that fee-for-service model, there's just very, very poor way to keep a program like ours afloat. So we do depend on philanthropy from the community through Transitions Life Care, which we're extremely grateful for and really benefits our patients who are receiving that type of care. And hospice, we have, like I said, been better able to be reimbursed. But even within that, there's the primary insurers that are obligated legally to provide that are Medicaid. Beyond that, each private insurance has developed, many of them have developed some type of concurrent care, but it differs with each one. And with some of them, we have not been able to successfully be reimbursed for the care we're providing. So there is room still within hospice to improve on that. And for sure, there is, you know, my hope is that in terms of your future directions question, I think that that is absolutely the area where I would hope to see legislation. We have been part of many conversations with folks in the political sphere to try to lobby for better funding for Medicaid to provide to palliative care teams to help ensure that that care is able to be funded and delivered to patients.
Yeah, that is a fantastic overview. We're speaking with Dr. Sophia Parascos. She is medical director of Transitions Kids, and we've got more with her right after this. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680 WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Jason Kong alongside Carson Sellers of Transitions Life Care, and we are speaking today with Dr. Sophia Parascos. She is medical director of Transitions Kids, and we have been doing a deep dive into Transitions Kids, and we have covered so much so far, and thankfully we have another segment that we can spend here with Dr. Parascos because we have even more questions, Carson, so let's get right to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So after our amazing overview, thank you for that, just a few broad questions to wrap things up. So for families facing the decision of whether to pursue pediatric hospice care in general, what guidance or support do you provide to help make the best decision for their child?
So this question by design is meant to be easier in the pediatric population than adult. And that's for the reason that we've been outlining. I think the goal is to have to choose to make that quote unquote choice as easy as possible. Hospice should be, from the family standpoint, an additional service and not a service that detracts from any of the other care they're receiving. And so if hospice is available as an option, I'm open with families that in order to be eligible for hospice, the criteria is that, you know, two doctors have to agree that the prognosis is on the order of 6 months or less if the disease runs its natural course, which can be a hard conversation to have in and of itself. And with the caveat that in kids and adults, but even more in kids, we are very prognostication, that effort to try to predict how much time someone has left is notoriously challenging. And kids will, I think this is much another difference on the kids side compared to adults, is that our children will come on hospice if you have something like a neurological condition. Oftentimes that means that you will be more at risk for things like pneumonia. The winter time is obviously a very challenging time for many of our families with all the germs. A lot of our kids will get a respiratory illness, you know, look like they're really declining, be eligible for hospice, come on to hospice, and then maybe they take a really, really long time to recover, but they do get back to a baseline that suggests that maybe they're not declining on the order of 6 months or less. And at that point, we need to discharge them, but we discharge them back to our palliative care service. And we've gotten much better just because of the frequency with which that happens in pediatrics of, you know, patients coming onto service, onto hospice service, and then going back to the palliative care service line. And so that is something that that really is, we're hoping that it's not so much of a decision, but just an opportunity to say to parents, hey, if, you know, we think you're eligible for hospice now, hospice means more of a hands-on service. That's how I describe it. And so you have to be able to commit to a once weekly nursing visit, even if that's very short. That is really the criteria, but it opens up the door for after hours hands-on care. If it did, you know, end up that the child progressed and was actively dying, we would want those services to be available to the families. If, for example, we weren't, and I wanted to just mention that if we're not able to get symptoms managed in the home and we are approaching end of life, we need to do something like IV medicines or medicines through other routes besides the mouth or the G-tube. Our hospice home, which our adults, I think you guys have probably talked about on this show before, but our adults are able to benefit from our inpatient hospice in Raleigh. And that's open to kids too, but you do have to be on hospice for that to be an option for you. And so that would be something that, that would be available to them. So the goal of all these conversations, how do I support or guide families about this, is if you want that extra hands-on support, you are eligible from the time that we think you're in that last chapter. And ideally, you're not, if you want to continue to pursue disease directed therapies, you want to continue your chemo, or your, you know, advanced, you know, seizure medications, or your BiPAP or your trach, you know, vent combination, those things are all possible under the pediatric concurrent care benefit. And so my hope is that it's not so difficult of a choice. It's really, can you commit to that weekly visit with our team, which if you're still having a lot of other visits can actually be kind of challenging, but the goal is to make that choice as easy as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So even more specific in relation to Transitions Kids, for families or healthcare providers who want to refer a child to the Transitions Kids program, how can they do so? And what is the process for getting started with that?
So there are a couple ways providers can refer. If, you know, most of our referrals are coming from our local hospital system, and there is an online referral form that they can use to refer a child. But families also self-refer, and that is a viable strategy as well. I think the easiest thing to do is to just give out the main Transitions life care number. And if you call that main number, you will speak to a human being and you can say, I want to refer my child to Transitions Kids. I had a, or, you know, to the Children's Bereavement Program, if that's more the kind of support that you're looking for. And that would then get funneled to us through an email, and we can reach out to you and establish the best way to get connected. But that's probably the easiest.
Perfect. Dr. Sophia Peraskos, thank you so much for your time and your expertise today. We really appreciate the conversation and providing your unique perspective when it comes to Transitions Kids.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it was a joy to have you on the show. I want to let everyone know that if you go to transitionslifecare.org, hover over the patient's label on the main menu there, and on the drop-down menu, there's a section completely dedicated to Transitions Kids. So there's plenty of information available for you online at transitionslifecare.org. If you missed any part of this episode and want to go back and listen to it or share it with a family member or friend that you think would find this information helpful, be sure to go to WPTF.com, find the Aging Matters section, or you can search for Aging Matters wherever you get your podcasts and it will show up there. So that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of Carson Sellers, I'm Jason Kong, thanking you for listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 92.9 and AM 680 WPTF News, Talk, Traffic. Have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF AM 680 and WPTF.com. For more information, log on to transitionslifecare.org.